reel number three. You're describing your bombardment of the dye works chimney that the Germans were using.
Thank you very much. Yes. Well, this was a real nuisance to the infantry people because the Germans had got a post, I suppose, somewhere like halfway up the chimney, and could see into the infantry trenches, and they were very anxious to destroy the chimney, and had spent a good deal of their ammunition allowance on strafing it, you know. And so I asked if I could have a go, you know, and use seven rounds a week that we had, if I could use it all in 1 week's supply on this chimney. And so I saw the only way of achieving this, because my gun was about 4,000 yards behind this thing, this chimney, and I wouldn't like to say that, that may be a bit of an exaggeration, but anyhow, over 1,000 yards. And so I spent a few rounds in getting the range by firing into the base of it, where there are a good deal of buildings, and you could see the burst of a shell very easily. Anyhow, to cut a long story short, I was able, with the aid of a consummately good glare, who got a very good eyesight, and he was cut above the ordinary recruited soldier. He was one of the gunners, and he was acting with me and getting the right elevation and so to open fire. When once we got a hit on the base of the chimney, then I could give the final direction and say a minute, and it got down to really a minute degree, you know. To cut the story short, we got a hit bang where we wanted, in the middle of the chimney, and lo, nothing happened except this hole in the front of the chimney. And I said, well, think of that, that's a blind shell. And it wasn't. But now, this was naval ammunition we were firing, pointed shell, you see. And with this 4.7 gun, it's a very accurate shooting gun, and fortunately, but at any rate, to cut a long story short, this shell had done everything one would have hoped for. It had gone through the chimney and burst on the far side, because on a bright day, with a telescope, one could see the daylight, and you could see through it and what was on the other side of the shell. And lo and behold, when they had a bit of a storm or something of that kind, the chimney broke off at this. And it was in the orders. The Canterbury chimney has broken off where the big shell hole was. And so that was the Germans' lookout, you see, into our trenches. So it was, we were all very, very pleased, of course.
Your account of the making the jam tin bombs.
Yes.
And of the alterations to the driving bands and the shell shortage shows that the British Army had difficulties with supplies.
Yeah.
Did anything happen to you that gave an indication that German shells might not be as efficient as they should be? And did anything happen that indicated that their shells were made of cast iron, not of steel?
Yes. Well, this very one I was telling you about, one dropping on the pavé, within 20 yards of me. It was 20 yards away because I measured the distance, because I was hit here and I told you. And there was the German chicken, you know, I mean, scratch on the pavé.
Yes.
It just knocked off a few stones. But it was a very sensitive fuse they'd used, you see, quite right. I mean, what we were doing ourselves. And they got this round which nearly expended me, but fortunately must have pulverized instead of breaking up into nice bit. I got, as I say, I felt, but it's in my billet that night as I was undressing, the Captain Wilson, who was with me in my billet, said, "What on earth's happened to your thigh?" And I looked down and I found it was absolutely black and blue all down my leg. Mm-hmm. And I just got the blast, but no splinter.
What did it feel like when the blast actually hit your leg?
Oh, it just like being cut with a cane. Exactly like that. And I felt this. I felt there must be... there must have been the splinters, you see, got me. It was hurting badly. And, but no, so nothing will then. I realized it was just a blast that had got me. And literally, that was 20 yards away, so it shows what sort of... what must have happened to that high-explosive shell. High-explosive because it burst on the pavé. You see, it only made this sort of chicken's... And it's only a casualty was this bruised leg.
If we could return to the beginning of the First World War again, you had already seen quite a wide experience in the service before the First World War began. What did you think when it began? How did you see it affecting your career as a soldier?
I don't know. I don't think one thinks of that kind of thing. You just think, what are the parade orders for the day? And that. I really don't think you look ahead like that. Mm-hmm. I certainly didn't. I was much too take it or leave it, you know, attitude. And I think we all brought up into that, as far as I know. Don't you think so, Catherine? You wouldn't.
I think it was the keenness on doing the best thing, to make the best use of what was at hand. Wouldn't it?
Oh
be?
Yes.
I think that would have filled your minds.
Well, his improvisation was, of course, a great asset.
And the wish to get something done.
Yes.
Is that all right?
Yes. And this was the general feeling in the country.
Would you have said that, Lewis?
I would think so. I think... I mean... I never heard a grouse or complaint. I can't remember anybody saying, when is this blasted war going to end, or anything of that kind of thing. And they just... I felt that we'd been... we didn't want the war. It was forced on us, and that was that. We were going to see it through. I think it was that attitude everywhere, don't you, Cassie?
Yes, you were saying the eagerness with which people joined up, as far as your experiences were concerned.
Oh, yes. And the experience I had among a very raw crowd up at Sheffield, as I was telling you a little bit about.
You had to raise a battery.
Well, not only a battery, but a brigade and ammunition columns and things, the men fight, and all that sort of to plan it and divide up men, say you're this, you're that, and so on. And then in the middle of all this, I was handing over to, I think it was Wilson, who was helping me. I was suddenly ordered to go south and join this brigade division of artillery that was embarking for the front, and to take charge of the ammunition columns and so on.
With the battery and the ammunition column that you were raising at Sheffield, were there any particular personality difficulties that you had? Were all the people who joined up all honest people, or were there any problems?
I think I told you about the single case. No, I think there were different grades of it, and one I had to sort of repeat the question.
Did you have people join up in the beginning of the First World War who weren't always as honest?
Well, I would say the great majority were sound people who were anxious to do what they could for the country, knowing it was emergency was on us all. But on the other hand, I remember convening a court-martial and discharging a man with ignominy for having stolen from a comrade. So that I had no right to. And when I reported this, he said, well, the least you say about that, the better. You were exceeding your powers. But
How long did you think the First World War would last when it began?
Oh, I can't remember ever thinking about that. And I never heard it discussed. I think everybody was keyed up and only anxious we had really now gone all out for defeating the Germans.
When you went, how well equipped did you think you were when you went to France?
Well, I was only in a very humble position because I was commanding an ammunition column, and of a brigade and of artillery, and I would say I'd been in the Boer War, and one could, you may say, see the end of that very soon. It was the Boers couldn't possibly hold out much longer because they were being starved out and so on. But there was nothing like that in the First World War. And I think one always felt they were in for a long war, I think. Wouldn't you? Well, you wouldn't remember that part of it, Kathy.
I think people were more hopeful than that group, and said, oh, the war will soon be over. I do remember hearing that being said and realizing that a more serious time had come for the country.
Your particular ammunition column was well equipped with frost nails.
Oh no, I bought those from the. Oh yes, I think I must have. I can't remember where I got them, but I remember being warned before I went out that somebody else had trouble with those. So I think it was the Desperas, do you know, who spoke about it. Would I have known the Desperas there? Yeah? It was some friend who... I had warning. I didn't use my own intuition that that was going to happen. I was told definitely that was a trouble.
The horses slipping on...
The horses slipping on the pavé. Mm-hmm. Not the pavé, the cobblestones.
Mm-hmm. Mm. When it was frosty and icy.
Yes, frosty. Even wet. Mm-hmm.
What were frost nails?
Big headed, just like the ordinary nail, but instead of a flat head like that, it had a square head, so that when it was driven home, this square head protruded under the shoe and made these lumps all around the shoe.
As you went out with your column with these frost nails,
yeah.
Did this mean that your column could remain operational when others couldn't?
Yes, exactly. And we used to, I think I may have told you, quite frequently I used to unhook my leaders. We had six horses to each gun.